Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute. Recording live from snowy but beautiful Denver, Colorado, I'm sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Mr. Bob Hoban, and we are joined today by Hoban Minute alumni, Mr. Saul Kay. Saul, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks, guys, for having me.
And it's actually just about a year since we had you on the show for the first time. I want to talk just for a moment about the subject, the topic of that discussion, which was in the early days of the pandemic, we put out an episode called Can CBD Cure Coronavirus? We were talking about the claims and representations that we were already seeing companies make at that time about whether or not cannabinoids could have some kind of medical or therapeutic effect around the virus. And I think a year later, we have probably a little bit more insight on that than we did at that time. But it was such an exciting time, not in a in an uplifting way, not in a positive way, but you know, just capturing those conversations early on in this pandemic and to kind of look back a year later and think all we could really do at that time was speculate. Of course, we were all homebound. And we were just trying to get a wrap on this thing. Here we are a year later, and you know we have vaccinations happening at wide scale. Definitely interested to hear a little bit about how Israel is doing with its rollout and how life has changed. I went back and listened to us speaking for a few minutes on that podcast. You were saying at that time everything was shutting down. So I think a year later, let's start right there. What is life like today in Israel exactly just about 1 year later?
It's getting better, I guess. we are the number one lockdown country in the world. Most days of school missed, most sort of mishandling on one hand, but, you know, very low death counts on the other hand. So maybe something worked. A lot of things didn't work, but they've certainly pushed hard on the vaccinations. We're at, you know, 60% vaccinated. And it's rolled out really quickly, and we'll see what sort of happens with live events and gatherings. It's still, you know, kind of shut off. We only just opened restaurants this week. So they've had this slow easing plan to Corona, but it's all, in my opinion, centered around the elections, which are coming up in 11 days. So, you know, things will change once we have a result from the elections, which isn't necessarily expected. We had four elections last round, and I think we might have to go back to that again this time, which is, you know, also slowing down the cannabis rollout here in Israel, where they've promised legalization, and that's, you know, been put on the shelf again while we sort out the political mess.
Well, Saul, you raise so many interesting topics to dive into, but let's sort of just pick it up. Here we are, again, 1 year later from our conversation and 1 year from really the beginning of the widespread impact of Corona on business and the economy. And we all learned a lot. You talked about events. I'd love to hear your perspective on what you anticipate events looking like, particularly being in that business going forward. But also, let's talk a little bit about how business has changed. We're here a year later talking once again about this topic, and it's not like we've all sat there on our hands and haven't been able to conduct business, even though we haven't been able to get together face to face. It's been a tremendous learning curve over the last year, but you know, maybe begrudgingly at first with these video calls and the like, but over time it's become an accepted and very effective way at doing business. Nothing can replace face-to-face human contact for developing relationships and networking and the like, but virtual business has been fairly successful. What's your take on that?
I think it has. You know, people have adapted. We've gotten used to doing it, but I think the pace at which we would do it with face-to-face meetings hasn't been met, and that's still a challenge. We've had a lot of success, say, with PsyTech, which is our psychedelic conference, which we launched just before Corona, and we never did a live event. We've only done digital, and we've built sort of a fantastic network there, and the team's really, really good at building that ecosystem digitally, virtually, until we can all meet again. But as you said, nothing replaces those live events, the connections I've made, the industry network that I was, you know, able to create through that face-to-face meeting network. I think people are hungry for it again, and they're waiting to get out from out of Corona. And, you know, it was a pretty crappy year for cannabis internationally in general, a lot of promises, a lot of things didn't get achieved, didn't meet their goals. The market sort of kicked back. And all of that happened together with Corona. So I think people locked down, looked inside, did a lot of local business. I know here in Israel, I stopped doing a lot of international. We focused here. I'm about to open two pharmacies licensed in cannabis. We have a whole bunch of pharmacists that have gone through the courses. So I think a lot of people did that. They focused on what's here and now, not always what's potential to grab. And that has helped people become more focused on what they do in the industry, which is really interesting. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, I am. And I do think that it caused a lot of us to focus on what was sort of in our backyard, for lack of a better way to put it. But it also, for many of us, I do think it continued to open up international opportunities, especially in the Latin American market. I feel like the Latin American market was just climbing up this hill, and they got to the top of the hill, and then the world shut down, and everybody was desirous of having these relationships to build out what the great potential of that region could be, either for export or ultimately, as we've seen, because of the economic downturn, a real focus on domestic distribution. I'll be in Mexico next week helping with the finalization of the Senate bill before it gets over to the president's office. And that's an exciting thing that was driven in large part in terms of the timing because of the economic impact of COVID. So I do think that that's had an ability to maintain connections and even develop them in certain regions of the world. But I also know that being in Israel, you know, it's not right next to Brazil, even though there are longstanding relationships between those countries. But talk about events. And I want to transition and talk about the new frontier in psychedelics, but talk about the Canatech events and events as a general topic and see, where do you see that going? Because there is going to be the NoCo Hemp Expo at the end of next week here in Denver, Colorado. And they're expecting thousands of people per day. It will really be the first larger cannabis event in the United States in a very long time, although we did see one in Florida last week, the Champ Trade Show. What do you see on the horizon for in-person events? Is it a matter of vaccinating the masses? Is it a matter of people getting comfortable, or just the political discourse? Because what we've seen in the United States, people say, oh, the U.S. has done this or the U.S. has done that. The U.S. isn't the U.S. The U.S. is comprised of 50 different states, and there's at least three different camps amongst those states. Some that have been open for business from the very beginning, some that have been shut down from the very beginning, and some like Colorado that sort of play right in the middle. And people have migrated to those states largely that have been open throughout this pandemic, probably giving rise to the numbers we've seen across the globe. But my point is, it's that political dictation of discourse. It's really made people behave a certain way. So what do you think is going to drive events and gatherings again?
People want the in-person, you know, sports events are going to come back. And there's also so much confusion around Corona. Like, we're doing a lot of things that are dictated or mandated by our governments that don't often make a lot of sense. I just went to a spa. They just opened up sort of the tourism again. So we went to a spa. You have to have a green passport, which means you're vaccinated. Everyone is vaccinated, but yet you still all have to wear masks. So nothing really makes sense. But people are hungry for it. And I'm talking locally. I think events will remain local, like they were when we first met 5-6 years ago, when I went to one of those early events in Colorado, where people are still talking about what's decarboxylating cannabis type of thing, really early discussions. The local ecosystem, no matter where you look, is thriving. What you said about Mexico is exactly what's happened everywhere else. We all felt we're on the cusp of something really great happening regulatory-wise in a lot of places, Europe, Israel, Latin America, Australia, even Asia. We were going to do a Canatech last year in Thailand. I think we're going to go back. We're planning a Canatech event as soon as we get some clear direction here from the government as to how many people are allowed. Are we allowed all indoors? And it's for sure a hybrid virtual event so that we can host them, say, in Tel Aviv and New York at the same time, so that you could have a virtual event that is mixed with at least meeting people in your local ecosystem. And as international travel opens up, which I'm sure it is now going to start again, then we'll start to see some international play happening.
on this topic of events, it is noteworthy to see the excitement growing here for this NoCo event. It was going to be a big event anyways. It's amplified to just something so beyond where it would have been had we not all been locked down and forced to do business in this virtual way for the last year. And you can absolutely feel that in the lead up here in Denver as we're sitting about a week away from this event coming. There's just going to be a huge descendants of the cannabis industry, particularly the hempsters on Denver. And, you know, frankly, it is exciting. I want to shift over to this idea and topic of psychedelics, though, because I saw a quote from you recently, and obviously you took your background and experience with Canatech and brought that to SciTech, and you had this wonderful quote about how the worlds of cannabis and psychedelics are going to intersect because they are ultimately on the same pathway. These are botanical medicines that have all kinds of different applications from a therapeutic perspective. So give us a sense of what made you so excited and eager and quickly identify this emerging opportunity in psychedelics, which we are seeing play out here in the United States with recent reform measures from the last election. And I know we're also seeing developments in Israel. So catch us up to speed a little bit on what got you so interested in that space.
Well, like in cannabis, I guess, 6-7 years ago, when I started to look at it, I looked at, you know, what does the underground look like? The people that are doing it and have helped thousands of people here in Israel. And Israelis are pretty well-traveled. They go all around the world. They come back with these molecules, and they use them therapeutically. And there's a very, very high rate of PTSD here, which obviously leads to depression. And I was amazed that looking for mushrooms, once you find one, your eyes turned in and you can find more. And I started to find this huge underground network. That, for me, started to intersect with people who I'd met from the cannabis world. So there was two galaxies kind of colliding. And then you look at the impact of what these molecules are going to have on the future of mental health, from depression to anxiety to weight loss to just being happy and creative. That's a potentially massive market that's hugely undermet. I'm a pharmacist. I've been treating people, putting them on SSRIs and then, you know, working them off SSRIs for many years in order to try and rebalance this idea of what's happened in medicine, where we've run to this one molecule solution that really isn't a holistic solution for medicine today. And now we're going back to botanicals. And if, you know, cannabis provided us a clear pathway for a very, very safe set of compounds, then there are other very, very safe set of compounds that can follow a potentially similar pathway, a little different with psychedelics. They are laser-focused materials to your brain with a lot of historical protections around them. So we want to be able to maintain those protections even when we're introducing them into the modern world. It sometimes gets lost in translation where you get mushroom shops popping up everywhere. So it has to be a balance, but I saw the future coming where there is a general acceptance, and COVID has accelerated that acceptance with regulators. People are recognizing you can get home delivery of your medication, including your cannabis, which happens to now be essential. All of these things just make it a little bit easier.
No, that's an excellent perspective. And that momentum has drawn the attention of the investment community, the medical community, the government regulatory communities around the world. And I do see that as sort of increasing. And the SciTech events, I watched one the other day, and I saw an advertisement for another one talking about the benefits of ketamine, et cetera. These are conversations that need to be had and that need to be put front and center, because people need to understand, to your point, that there are other alternatives out there. And, you know, perhaps we are getting smarter. In fact, it's funny. My daughter asked me the other day, she says, so why is it that everybody's talking about these botanical, these natural remedies now, and historically, scientifically, pharmaceutical drugs have been the answer? Don't we know all this stuff already? And the answer is no, we don't know it. And it's a way certain generations have been indoctrinated by education, and that there are new things that actually work as effectively, if not more effectively, but it's contrary to the existing system that's been in place for so long that you've been educated in, I'm sure, at least initially, and so many physicians and medical doctors around the world are. Take us take us to Israel and talk about what's happening with domestic distribution of cannabis. It was big news maybe a year ago, maybe 9 months ago, where the legislature, the Knesset, said this is something we're going to promulgate. And I know, as you alluded to a few moments ago, that you're involved in that process. What's the status? What's the prospects of an industry within Israel for domestic distribution of cannabis?
So right now, we've had massive patient growth. We're around 100,000 patients, which has kind of doubled in the last year. Many, many more doctors who are approved to directly prescribe. 114 different dispensaries or pharmacies that have cannabis licenses. So a lot more sort of infrastructure that's allowed the growth, which is why we've had to import, I think it's now close to 10 tons of cannabis from international sources to meet the demand, because the rollout of the program here for licensing of grows and genetics and distribution was slower than the patient growth. So we sort of hit a wall with that. But those are good indicators that there is going to be a robust cannabis economy here. And 10 tons isn't a joke anymore. And 100 plus dispensaries starts to look like Denver 5 years ago, which was an interesting market to play in. And this is for a population of 8-9 million, plus the Arab population, if you want to add that on top. That becomes a nice-sized state within the United States with a very small number of players, and strong talk of legalization in either the upcoming or the next election after that. So good indicators for a strong domestic market. No movement yet on the sort of capital markets. They're all kind of quiet. Again, waiting to see that this true patient growth and that the money is coming at the end of the day in, and I think that then investors will come in, and especially into the public side.
Certainly going to be an exciting thing to watch, especially as these elections are ongoing. And Saul, when is that election? When can we expect to see some update on whether or not that legislation is going to be passed in the near future?
You know, the elections are in a week and a half's time. It'll take them 2 weeks to form a government. Two of the major parties that are running, which are the Likud party, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu's party, have promised legalization. They've even promised a time frame of 9 months. I think that's a little aggressive and won't happen. But it does, again, give an indication that they want this. They see the money on the table, right? There's a huge black market here. 23% of Israeli citizens smoke cannabis. They have an increasing number of fines, which they're giving out to people who are carrying, you know, single joints. Those aren't things that the government wants to do. They want to make good money on this, and I think they can. We have to help them and incentivize them to get that done. And elections are good for that, because it's a time for change. So we're hoping for good news. But in the meantime, I've got some dispensaries, so they can take a couple more years now on the recreational and let me play in the medicine.
Absolutely. And we'll be watching that closely and make sure to have you, because you're already an alumni on this show, come back on. But I want to touch on one thing before we end, which is the question that your daughter asked you, Bob, because I think in a conversation around psychedelics, it is just a fascinating point to make, which is, I'm just going to ask it as a question and give us the legal perspective on this. But before the 20th century, did we treat plants? Did governments treat plants the way that we have seen them be treated since the Controlled Substances Act, the Marijuana Tax Act? Was this prominent before the 1900s, where plants and botanical medicines were ever really put in this category? If you can't grow it, you can't cultivate it, can't use it, can't distribute it to people? Or was this really something that is just part of our global history over the last 120 years?
Well, I can't speak from a medical training perspective, and Saul can probably comment on that, but from a legal and policy development standpoint, historically, the development of medicines within the United States has been based around a mix of synthetic or synthesized compounds and plant-based compounds. The FDA rules are driven to put both on equal footing. However, because of the fast development of the pharmaceutical complex that's, you know, created so much wealth for so many people that fall within that complex, and the loosening of advertising restrictions over the last decade or two, that's created a society that is reliant on synthetic compounds for just general well-being, and it's not well-being. I put well-being in quotes there. So I think what we're doing is we're coming back around to recognize that the laws and the public policy have always put both on equal footing from a medicinal benefit standpoint. It can be developed, approved, and distributed through the medical system. But it was easier to produce these compounds by pharmaceutical producers, drive those to the general public, than it was to sell them on the notion of plants. Now, that was compounded further, as your point, about the Controlled Substances Act. Because of the beginning in the early 1900s in the United States, looking at every plant-based compound as a blight on society. If it makes people feel good, we have to control it and then put it in this box over here. Forget about whether it has any medicinal benefit or not. We need to stop this behavior right away, which was also impacted by this temperance movement in the 20s in the United States, which was, of course, the very conservative movement. If you look at it through that lens, it's no wonder why we're in this situation today where every other commercial on television has to do with taking a pharmaceutical synthetic pill to make you feel better in a particular way. But we're coming around to this reawakening, if you will, which sounds silly, but that's really what it is. To my daughter's point is, if this was really an option, why wasn't it an option before? Well, almost for the very same reason that cannabis is vilified on a global basis by politicians that don't pay attention to what's happening now because of the false stigma that was attached to it, because they wanted to control certain populations. That was a sign of the times. And just like politics in any country, especially in the United States, it takes a good 70 to 100 years to change direction. That's what we're seeing right now. And we're not just at the very beginning of that, but we are significantly in the mix of that. So what's your take on that from a scientific or even public policy standpoint? Why is it that we're finally coming around to recognize that these botanical compounds, these natural things, can improve our lives when we've been sold this other narrative for so very long?
I think cannabis led the way to that, and I think there's a trickle-down effect to what we're seeing in, you know, general nutrition, right? We know that eating red tomatoes are good for us, and we know that drinking wine is good for us. So as scientists, well, we've got to look for that one compound in that tomato which we found, and it's called leucopene, and then we extract it and we make it in bioreactors and we give it to you in a, you know, natural food supplement, making no, you know, real claims, only functional claims, of course. So that hasn't really worked. We haven't seen the miracle of food supplements. We haven't seen that synthetic THC works better than whole plant THC. We've seen the opposite, that when you distill it down to the single molecule in science, it's not the answer. And that leads us back to, okay, so maybe it's all those molecules together. So now we'll go down the route of a few years of taking all those molecules and putting them together ourselves, and then realize, well, you know, that isn't how God or nature intended, and maybe we'll go back to the original plants. I think it is a process, and a long, long process. It's not overnight. You can't leave out also the opium wars, and you can't leave out prohibition from regulators of approached drugs. And you look at things like the analog law, which then just throws everything under a microscope, because you can be stopped if you're carrying, you know, white chalk in your pocket. So that becomes a police tool in order to, you know, maintain some policing over the people. So you can't remove police and politics and prohibition and drug abuse from this. This is how we evolve as human beings to get a better society. We tried the prohibition. That wasn't good. All right, so we're going to try and let it out and be completely free. I'm sure that's not good either. There's a famous Jewish philosopher, the Rambam, who says, you know, you go to each extreme, but eventually you come back to the middle road, because the extremes are never good. So something that works in the middle, and it just takes time to figure out what that middle ground is and how it all works.
I hope that's true in American politics, because we've seen it vacillate back and forth way too much.
Absolutely. And yeah, this historical context, you know, in the conversation of psychedelics is fascinating for anybody who wants to tune into more conversations like this, to be at the cutting edge of what's going on with cannabis, how it intersects with psychedelics. You can stay up with Saul Kay at canna-tech.co or scitechglobal.com. please sign up for one of their events. They are absolutely invaluable. Saul, thank you for taking some time to be here with us this morning, and we can't wait to have you again on the show.
That's my pleasure, Dave. Thank you. Stay safe, and I look forward to an in-person event really soon, and a robust industry that is definitely coming. Nothing really can stop it. But that's what, you know, we kind of said about gambling in the USA digitally, and, you know, things can get stopped. We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law, and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.